So I was mentioning at home that this is probably the 15th time that I've spoken on Super Bowl Sunday. So welcome to that day. Anyway, our work ourselves. Valeda Sekholi, a psychologist from New York City, wrote in 2012, "In considering what makes life distinctly human and meaningful, Freud famously wrote, love and work are the cornerstones of our humanness. And indeed they are. They are the very foundation on which we build a meaningful life. Think about it. Our lives revolve hour after hour on our relationships with others, and they are organized and structured by our work. This is so whether our work and our relationship are enjoyable or not. At the end of the day, we have constructed something, some meaning from interactions with others and in interacting with what we do. The balance between love and work in our lives has a direct impact on our experience of ourselves in the context of our lives." So work is indeed an important part of our lives, and for many of us, it's what we devote the greatest part of our working hours to doing. And work raises a multitude of ethical questions. Are the products or services good for or harmful to society or to the environment, as we heard earlier? Are wages equitable? Are work conditions humane? But my question today is more about this. To what degree is work essential to us as individuals and to us as a society of people? That is, under what conditions can work be seen as an end in and of itself, rather than simply a means to an end? What would make work intrinsically valuable to us and to others? Although one way to get us thinking about work along these lines is to imagine life without work. I'd come across this passage when I was doing some other studies, and it just really struck me, so I'm going to share it with you. It's a bit long, but I think you'll find it intriguing. This is from an article by Bill Joy in Wired, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us, and it's entitled The New Luddite Challenge. First, let us postulate that the computer scientists succeed in developing intelligent machines that can do all things better than human beings can do them. In that case, presumably all work will be done by vast, highly organized systems of machines, and no human effort will be necessary. Either of two cases might occur. The machines might be permitted to make all of their own decisions without human oversight, or else human control over the machines might be retained. If the machines are permitted to make all their own decisions, we can't make any conjectures as to the results, because it's impossible to guess how such machines might behave. We only point out that the fate of the human race would be at the mercy of the machines. It might be argued that the human race would never be foolish enough to hand over all the power to the machines, but we are suggesting neither that the human race would voluntarily turn power over to the machines, nor that machines would willfully seize power. What we do suggest is that the human race might easily permit itself to drift into such a position, of such dependence on the machines that it would have no practical choice but to accept all the machines' decisions. A little scary, isn't it? Anyway, as society and the problems that face it become more and more complex and the machines become more and more intelligent, people will let machines make more and more of their decisions for them simply because machine-made decisions will bring better results than man-made ones. Eventually, a stage may be reached at which the decisions necessary to keep the system running be so complex that human beings will be incapable of making them intelligently. At that stage, the machines will be in effective control, making their own selves. People won't be able to just turn the machines off because they will be so dependent on them that turning them off would amount to suicide. Speaking of which, you guys all have your cell phones off, right? Just checking. Oh. On the other hand, it is possible that human control over the machines may be retained. Yay. Okay. In that case, the average man may have control over certain private machines of his own, such as his car or personal computer. But control over the large systems of machines will be in the hands of a tiny elite, just as it is today, but with two differences. Due to improved techniques, the elite will have greater control over the masses. And because human work will no longer be necessary, the masses will be superfluous, a useless burden on the system. If the elite is ruthless, they may simply decide to exterminate the mass of humanity. If they are humane, they may use propaganda or other psychological or biological techniques to reduce the birth rate until the mass of humanity becomes extinct, leaving the world to the elite. Or if the elite consists of soft-hearted liberals, they may decide to play the role of good shepherds to the rest of the human race. They will see to it that everyone's physical needs are satisfied, that all children are raised under psychologically hygienic conditions, that everyone has a wholesome hobby to keep him busy, and that anyone who may become dissatisfied undergoes treatment to cure his problem. Of course, life will be so purposeless that people will have to be biologically or psychologically engineered, either to remove their need for the power process or make them supplement their drive for power into some make them sublimate their drive for power into some harmless hobby. These engineered human beings may be happy in such a society, but they will most certainly not be free. They will have been reduced to the status of domestic animals. Well, that's a nice start to the day. So anyone here know who wrote that passage? No guesses? It was actually Ted Kaczynski, also known as the Unabomber. And if you're not familiar with Ted, he had bombs that he sent in a letter or left at people's doorsteps, killed 3 people, injured 23 others. Currently serving 8 life sentences at a maximum security prison in Colorado. Ironically, he was turned in, by the way, by his brother, who was honored by the American Ethical Union a few years back. What Ted had done is insist that the New York Times publish his manifesto, which this is part of. When they did that at the FBI's request, the sister-in-law recognized Ted's thinking in there and told the brother to read it, and he read it, and he said, "Oh my God," and then they turned him in, and there he goes. So, just wildness. The thing is, I mean, looking at this again, how did that sit for you all? I mean, clearly this is a guy who had significant problems with mental illness and anger control. But that doesn't mean that he was completely off base, does it? So, by the way, a scientist acquaintance of mine who's worked for NASA for many years assured me that artificial intelligence is quite a long way off. You know, he's very reassuring. And that the first scenario of machines taking over and running things is pretty unlikely in our lifetimes, according to him. Now, mind you, scientists have been wrong, too. The second scenario, though, did really wake me up. Right now, I think there's 62 people that control like 85% of the world economy. Isn't it something like that? Yeah, it did have me wondering, for sure. Anyway, so with all the talking about the importance of jobs, I wonder about the importance of workers. You know, I think one of the startling things from Kaczynski's piece was that from a business point of view, workers are actually much more of a liability than an asset, right? If you can trim down your workforce and have fewer of them, that's actually better for you than to have more of them. And on the other end, though, we have this idea that somehow work is important and vital to us as human beings. And finding ways to fit those two things together, I find, is a little complicated. Now, I was thinking through this and came upon some thinking from Felix Adler, who was the founder of the First Ethical Society and of the ethical culture movement, had his opus effort here called An Ethical Philosophy of Life. Very difficult book. I don't really encourage you to read it unless you really like philosophy and like digging into things deeply. However, in the second third of the book, I guess, he talks about the effort to deal with sin and bereavement and death, or sin, sickness, and death, rather. And in the course of it, he really talks a lot about what the work is for people that are engaged in dealing with these things. And that got me thinking about how we look at work. You know, when you say the word work, most people think about what you get paid to do. Right? However, is that really what we want to be thinking about as our work? For so many of us, we don't really find a great deal of intrinsic value in our day-to-day work lives. Right? It might be minimal. And sadly, right now, for many, many people, they don't get much material value out of their work life either. Right? So we have a situation right now where we have a lot of people putting time and energy into stuff that may not really capture that sense of work should be an important part of your life, except for keeping the food on the table, I guess. Anyway, and reading Ethical Philosophy of Life again, I was, you know, thinking about the main axiom that we talk about so frequently, you know, always act to elicit the best of others and thereby in oneself. And he has this little rant on that at the beginning of this section that took me by surprise, actually. So I'm going to read a little bit of it. So act as to develop the faculties of thy fellow man. Sorry, women hadn't been invented yet when he finishes. Faculties of my fellow person is not the rule proposed. So act as to develop the so-called good qualities in the person. It is not the rule. That's not the rule proposed. All right, so let me try this one so again. I've got to read it through. Okay. So act as to develop the faculties of thy fellow man is not the rule proposed. So act as to develop the so-called good qualities in the man is not the rule proposed. Right? These are the no's. The rule reads, act so as to bring out the spiritual personality, the unique nature of the other. Putting the matter this way, we incurred the danger of seeming to concentrate attention on the individual as he detached to being. We seem to have him only in mind, though it is true in respect to what is intrinsic in him, the irreducible ethical units, which he essentially is. When we greet Adler these days, we often kind of restrict ourselves to this thinking about, oh, you're going to elicit the best of others, you're going to elicit the best of others. He had a very different idea about what that meant and what that was about. And I think he tried to address what I consider a significant limitation in humanism, which is humanism is very committed to what is and probably overcommitted to what's known, right? What is and what's known. When in fact the great majority of stuff in this universe we don't even know to know about. Rumsfeld? You know, there's the known knowns and the unknown knowns and the unknown unknowns. Those things that are so far out there that we don't even know that we don't know about them, right? But that's probably the majority of the universe. And for us to focus our lives around the known knowns has some limitations that we may not be happy with down the road, right? Especially in a machine-led universe. I think one of the things that is special about humanity is our creative power, our power to imagine, to appreciate, to really get into something, to say, this could be so cool, right? To get enlivened by that. And yet we need to have an expectation that when we are working toward that end, we're going farther than just making a few people happy or helping a person hone their skills in a few places, or to, you know, help somebody do something. It's bigger than that from Adler's point of view. Now, mind you, I don't know how successful he was in really, you know, unpacking all this, and the language and all those sorts of things didn't necessarily resonate with me. But the task does. The task to really get into life in such a way that it is important, it's critical, it's essential, is something that we just don't get unless we open up our minds to a possibility that's beyond what we expect. Beyond what we expect. Now, the thing about work is, and especially in the last few decades, work seems to be getting more and more quantitatively oriented. I worked in the human services field for like 40 years now. And over time, more and more of the workday is getting into these countable little snippets. Most recently, and by the way, that's what seems to be driving when they talk about productivity, even in the not-for-profit world, oftentimes they're talking about profitability. Right? Even if you're not for profit, you still have to find some way to pay your employees and pay your rent and all those kind of things. And so when they talk about productivity, they're really talking about what are we doing that is bringing the cash in the door so that we can keep doing what we're looking to do. All right? The most recent event with that, with the Guidance Center of Westchester, and the board has been getting increasingly nervous about the risk that is there from unused and unpaid vacation time, right? I mean, what does this have to do with service? Like nothing. But it's a risk. It's the numbers that are really becoming important in driving decisions. And the decision was to cut back the number of days people got. Well, that worked out for some people, I'm sure. So many places in our lives are now being counted and that sort of thing. It's also a reflection of what is a growing monetization of our work lives, right? That is really more about the earnings and an effort to get people to work for money. I got to say, I've been really moving my life towards jobs where I don't feel like I'm working to get paid all this time. And by the way, that doesn't mean I'm looking forward to not getting a paycheck this next month. However, when I think about why am I doing this, the paycheck rarely makes the top five for me. That is a position of privilege. And it was hard to get. And there aren't too many of those spots around, unfortunately, right? Not too many of those spots around. But isn't that what we really want to see from work? We want to see from work that the work itself has such value for us that we want to do it, that we want to be part of that, that that's what we want to be aiming for, right? And quite frankly, the payment back is kind of almost an extraneous thing, except when you're not getting compensated to a degree where you can put food on the table, pay your rent, pay your health care bills, etc. And that is a growing population, even in our own communities. I was at a fiscal fairness morning a few weeks back, and Ed Deutsch, who's the executive director of the Fiscal Policy Institute, was the keynote. And he was showing us slides after slides of things that were happening in terms of the economy. So one of the slides he showed that in New York State, there's been over 30% increase in income for the state overall between 2008 and 2012. A 30% increase in income. 100% of that went to the top 1% of earners. 100%. Right? The 99% at the bottom actually saw a slight decrease, less than 2%. But still, that's what happened. All right? Another slide he showed was the poverty index for cities in New York State. Are you aware that there's like 8 cities where more than 50% of the children are living in poverty in New York State? More than 50%. Astounding, isn't it? And a lot of these children are in families where people are working. In Westchester County, we have people who are just struggling away. They're working hard, but they're not getting enough income to pay for their basic stuff, even when they're living in really dangerous and impoverished situations. Work for them is going to be very difficult to have intrinsic value. Right? I mean, how tired must people be trying to string together a life with that kind of situation? So I'd like us to be thinking differently about work. and in particular, your work. Your work may very well involve situations where you go someplace, do something, and they pay you for it. I'd like you to think about your work beyond that. Your work here with the society can be work. Your work in your community can be work, even if you're not getting paid for it. In fact, especially if you're not getting paid for it. In Adler's piece, when he's talking about dealing with sickness, he's really saying, you know, so what is the work of the person who is ill and dealing with the pain and suffering that they have? What is the work of that person? And his reply is the work is to really use this opportunity to notice how much you appreciate your connectedness to other people in the world. To find a way past your pain to an awareness of the lives of others who are part of your life. And to engage with them in such a way that you experience a deeper connection and an abiding sense of almost a spiritual sense of being part of a world that goes beyond your immediate pains, that goes beyond your immediate needs and suffering, but demonstrates to yourself that you are a unique and special, irreplaceable human being, as are the people around you. Our work can be in that direction, especially our work that we take on voluntarily and that we take on in order to experience that sense of connection and helpfulness. And when we engage in work of that kind, we might also be looking to move things in a direction where more people have the opportunity to experience that in their work. I mean, there's so many things we could be doing right here in Westchester County. I mean, the affordable housing situation is a mess. We have the police accountability, which is still struggling along. There are so many places, tax equity. There are so many places where we can get involved in really helping people have lives that include a sense of richness and a possibility that they can spend time and energy engaging in work that also helps them transport themselves to a place that is rich and full and enlivening and connecting with other people. So that's what we should do. Thanks.